Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Shannon Ganyu, author of A Memoir of Conversion to Judaism and Creating an Active Jewish Life, a new book called Since Sinai. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. This week features the longest days of the year in the Northern Hemisphere, with the summer solstice coming June 21st. There are Jewish holidays associated with each of the equinoxes, by the way, spring in March, autumn in September, and of course with the winter solstice in December, but there are no Jewish sun-related holidays in June. This demonstrates some interesting things about Judaism and all religion. Judaism, like other ancient religions, views God as creator of the natural universe. But rather than seeing the sun and moon as gods themselves, or the stars and planets as independent entities, we have always understood the entirety of nature as the result of God initiating creation. You can call this a religious form of the Big Bang Theory, if you like. I tend to think of it that way. God began all creation out of nothing, creation ex nihilo, and the central idea is simply that the sun, moon, planets, stars, galaxies, and other celestial entities revolve, rotate, expand, contract in ways initiated by God's original act of creation. These heavenly bodies aren't seen as impacting our lives directly through some spiritual or mystical process. But we Jews are influenced by our surrounding cultures, and we are interested in utilizing some of the ideas others have found relevant and important. We just use them in ways that demonstrate the central idea of one God, monotheism, and God's role in forming and shaping the entirety of the universe. In nearly every culture in the world, the place of the sun in the sky has been of interest, often a central focus for religious practice. In Egypt, the sun god Ra was a central deity, as was Aton, the solar disk. Mesopotamians worshipped Shamash, the sun god, whose name became the word for sun in Hebrew, Shemesh. Other ancient peoples worshipped the sun in a variety of ways, and most traditions created special rituals and monumental religious places dedicated to the sun's cycles. From Stonehenge in Britain to the Konark Sun Temple in India to the Temple of the Sun in Beijing to the Pyramid of the Sun in Teotihuacan near Mexico City. Because of the predictable cyclical quality of the solar year, nearly every region and people on Earth has ritual holidays associated with the dates when the days are shortest and the nights longest, the winter solstice, and the days longest and the nights shortest, the summer solstice, as well as dates when the days and nights are of equal duration, the spring and fall equinoxes. Those holidays had various names and rites, from the Babylonian Nisanu spring festival to the Midsummer Day in Scandinavia and Celtic lands, to the fall festival in Vietnam and China, to the Roman Saturnalia that later was transformed into, you know, Christmas. Judaism developed rituals and holidays around these solstices and equinoxes, too. Pesach, Passover, near the vernal equinox in spring, is our Chag HaAviv, the springtime freedom festival. Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, and Sukkot, our harvest holiday, occur around the fall equinox. And in winter, of course, Hanukkah, the festival of lights, comes at the darkest time of year, right near the winter solstice. So even though Jews don't acknowledge any special religious significance to the cycles of the sun, our Jewish calendar is actually based on the moon and the lunar cycle, we still manage to cover three of the four special solar times with important festivals. We do so with holidays that are officially unrelated to the sun worship that others practice, in keeping with a kind of Jewish genius for adopting practices and customs of other peoples or traditions, but utilizing them to advance Jewish ideas and values. Jews do this for spring, fall, and winter dates, all the obvious times, but not the summer solstice coming up this week. So while we certainly acknowledge there is no religious reason to have a summer solstice Jewish festival, it does seem odd that Jews connect the other three crucial periods of the year for solar religiosity to holidays, while on the one day of the year that seems most likely to inspire religious connection, we've got Bubkis, nothing. Perhaps we don't do anything for the summer solstice precisely because it was such an important element for so many ancient, antique religious traditions. In Israel, the Essenes, an ascetic Jewish religious group active in Israel during the first century CE, were the only sect to use a solar calendar rather than our lunar one. At the time, nearly 2,000 years ago, Essenes were one of about, 25 different Jewish religious sectarian groups in Israel. Archaeologists have found that the largest room in the ruins of Qumran, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, was actually a sun temple. This week, during the summer solstice, the rays of the setting sun will shine at 286 degrees, not Fahrenheit, that's along the arc, along the building's longitudinal axis, and they will illuminate the eastern wall of this ancient room. It's oriented at exactly the same angle as the Egyptian shrines dedicated to the sun. Ancient authorities, including the historian Josephus and the philosopher Philo of Alexandria, wrote that the Essenes worshipped the sun. Well, in a world permeated by the glow of sun worshippers, Judaism found itself in a position in which it needed to avoid establishing anything that might become a catalyst for even more solar devotion. And so, we have no summer solstice celebrations this week, no special dedications on behalf of solar devotionals. But the days are sure long now and filled with light. That's not a bad thing. And so to play us in this morning on the theme of light, here's Beth Schaefer singing her Or Chadash, a new light from the Psalms.
Or Chadash, Or Chadash, Al Tzion Tahi. Or Chadash, Or Chadash, Al Tzion Tahi. Kehulanu Mehira Oro Venis Kehulanu Mehira Oro Hadash
That was Beth Schaefer singing Or Chadash, a new light for the longest, lightest day of the year coming this week. Our guest this morning, Shannon Gagneau, a Jew by choice and author of a new memoir of her conversion to Judaism and describing how she created an active Jewish life, is here to talk about her book called Since Sinai. Find out all about her and her new book when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Shannon Gagneau is a practicing attorney, an author on Jewish subjects, and most importantly for her book this morning, Since Sinai, A Convert's Path to Judaism, A Jew by Choice. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you so much. Good morning to you as well.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you something that was asked at your intro interview with the cantor and then by a 12-year-old while you were serving soup. Why did you want to be Jewish?
Yeah, so I think for a lot of people who grew up without access to Jews and Jewish ideas, there's this assumption that Judaism is Christianity without the Jesus component or Christians waiting for their Messiah. And I grew up in a really Catholic hometown, and by the time I got to college, hadn't had any exposure to Judaism. But the thing that made a difference to me was meeting all of these students and professors who were Jewish and getting a window into Jewish worldviews, Jewish holidays that I was previously unfamiliar with, Purim, which a lot of non-Jews don't know is celebrated, and getting to see my Jewish classmates get excited about the high holidays and get excited about birthright trips. And I always tell people there were just sparks. I was really curious about Shabbat and how different people observed it. I was really curious about, okay, what are you eating during Passover? Can I try a matzah pizza? And there was this inexplicable pull, and the pull just got stronger and stronger and stronger until it moved from I'm curious to I'm Googling how to become a Jew, until it progressed into I'm signing up for a conversion program in Chicago. And I think a lot of converts experience that gravitational pull towards Judaism because it's just a match. It's the right fit. And even if it feels difficult because most people don't know a lot of other Jewish converts, it's the right decision, and it keeps sort of poking you in the back until you take that step.
So as a rabbi who's done a lot of outreach and worked with many Jews by choice over the years, I can say that the idea that there's some kind of a spark, that there's sort of a sense of return, is often a factor for a lot of people. Did you feel some of that?
I did. You know, the first time I experienced a real Shabbos was I arranged to visit one of my best college friends in Needham, Massachusetts over our summer break. And it's a pretty Shomer Shabbos community. It surrounds a big Jewish high school. And so we lit candles, her mom made a nice kosher dinner, and then different people from the community sort of walked in and out because people in that community don't drive on the Shabbos, they don't turn on lights, so it becomes this neighborhood gathering, especially in the summer, where people are just walking in and out of each other's homes, having some fruit, sharing conversations. And for me, it wasn't even a thought of, oh, this is so nice, this is a pleasant evening. It was like, I am meant to be part of this community. This is where I belong, and these traditions are something that speaks to a really deep part of my soul, even if I can't quite figure out why that is, because of course you give extra tzedakah on the Shabbos, but I mean, Christians have their own version of charity and also their own rituals for the home, but it just felt like this is what it was meant to be for me. And I don't know if I've ever been able to fully explain it to myself, but I think that's where it started, and it just got stronger ever since.
We will talk much more with Shannon Gagneau about her book, Since Sinai, A Convert's Path to Judaism, why she decided to write it, and what's missing in a lot of the luminous numbers of books that are available to Jews and people studying Judaism when we come back in a moment here on Two Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a fabulous array of services, classes, and events this summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org. We welcome members and guests in person, safely, and of course on our Facebook page. Call 520-276-5675 for more information on Beit Simcha. Our synagogue's located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person Friday night and Saturday morning. You can email me, rabbi at beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHATucson.org. Or join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services. They start at 6:30 p.m. Full music. Saturday Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m. All with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BEITSIMCHA Tucson. Our services are in person and virtually. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are available live and on Zoom. Access those by going to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or emailing me, rabbi at BeitSimcha, BEITSIMCHA, Tucson.org. Our wonderful religious school and Torah Tikes programs, Bar Bat Mitzvah, Confirmation, and High School programs, and, well, lots more are available in blended formats, some students live, some on Zoom. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, schools, Adult Education Academy classes, life cycle events, and everything else, go to Beit Simcha Tucson, BEITSIMCHATucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest-growing Jewish congregation and community in all of Arizona in its exciting beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or a criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com, T-O-O Jewish Radio 18 at Gmail, or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, 2JewishRadio.com, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine, over 175,000 downloads on Podbean. Post a rating, review 2Jewish wherever you listen to our podcast. All those comments help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So this morning, let's talk about a Jewish community that a lot of us don't know very much about, although it's quite ancient and accomplished, the Jewish community of Libya.
Well, funny you should ask about that, because you and those of your listeners who follow my podcast series Around the Jewish World with Tom Price, will discover that the most recent episode is about Libya. So I'm very happy to talk about it. And you mentioned that it was ancient. There's some debate about how ancient it is, actually. The sort of Libyan Jewish origin myth claims that Jews have been there for 2,800 years, since before the destruction of the first temple.
Okay, that seems elaborate.
It seems far-fetched, but there's archaeological evidence of the ruins of a synagogue that was built and used in the 10th century before the Common Era. In other words, during the reign of King Solomon. Now, I know that the conventional wisdom is that synagogues didn't exist before the destruction of the first temple.
And not even for like several hundred years after the rebuilding of the second temple.
But this was definitely a Jewish house of worship in a place called Sirte, and it's definitely dated by archaeological evidence to the 10th century BCE.
Wow.
We know from many abundant written records that at the time of the Ptolemies in the 4th century BCE, there was already a very large Jewish community in Libya before the Greeks arrived. So maybe 2,800 years is an exaggeration, although then one wonders how those ruins got there.
Yeah, that is a peculiar thing.
But it certainly seems that 2,400 years is not an exaggeration at all.
Sure.
So it's one of the few places in the Mediterranean where Jewish communities predated the Roman Empire.
Like it goes back to Carthaginian times then, probably. Oh,
Carthaginian times are much later.
Even before that, all right.
They're during the Common Era. We're talking about the 4th century BCE. Carthage and the Punic Wars
are 200 BCE, 300 BCE, Hannibal, all that stuff.
Okay, if you say so.
You'll have to trust me on that.
I will. I always do. So, the antiquity of the Jewish community of Libya is one thing. The magnitude is quite a different thing. In the 2nd century of the Common Era, so after the destruction of the Second Temple, and when the Mediterranean was already considered a Roman lake, Libya had 500,000 Jews.
Wow.
A very large Jewish community. And that fluctuated over time as different waves of conquest. The Romans were replaced by the Byzantines, who in turn were replaced by the Arabs, who in turn were replaced by the Turks, who in turn were replaced by Spaniards. And ultimately, Italy conquered Libya in 1911 and made it an Italian colony through World War II. Which had the unfortunate impact of importing all the anti-Jewish legislation that existed under Mussolini because of the Italian alliance with Nazi Germany. All that applied in Libya. So in the course of the 20th century, there were like four waves of destruction that we'll get into in just a minute, plus a pretty miraculous story of liberation and salvation for a good chunk of Libyan Jewry, like 2,500 people, during the Six-Day War, which occurred 55 years ago this week.
Wow. Tom, we will talk next week much more about the Libyan Jewish community. I have to admit, I didn't know almost anything about. We'll talk next week. Thanks so much.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A lady golfer visits a driving range to practice her game. She's about to drive her first ball when she notices the man next to her. Pardon me, sir, she says, you're aiming in the wrong direction, towards the golf shop. Oi, thanks for that. Without you, I wouldn't know I'm blind. The man turns around and starts hitting golf balls the right direction into the range. After a few minutes, he asks the lady how he's doing. Not bad, she answers, your shots are straight and long. Thanks again, miss, he replies. Without your telling, I wouldn't know these things. A few shots later, he inquires again. You mind I should ask you a poisonal question? Not at all, she replies. Valley says, I don't do so well with the ladies. Am I ugly? Am I fat? You're quite presentable, she replies. I don't think that's a problem. Smiling now, he exults, what a relief. I always was afraid to ask. Again, I must thank you. He was about to hit another ball. The woman interrupted him. Do you mind if I give you a bit of advice, she asks? With much gladness, all the help you got, I will take, he answers. Lose the Jewish accent, the lady golfer says. You're Chinese. That was the old Jewish joke of the week special, feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we chant the dramatic portion of Shlach Lecha in the book of Numbers, the story of the Meraglim, the spies. The Israelites have journeyed to the borders of the Holy Land just a year and a half after leaving Egyptian exile. Under God's direction, Moses sends 12 spies, one from each tribe, princes of the people, wealthy men of standing, into the land of Canaan to scout the land and see if it will be capturable. The spies take a month. They tour the whole land and report back to Moses. Canaan is very good, flowing with milk and honey. They even bring back a huge cluster of grapes, so large it must be carried by two men on a pole. That's now the enduring symbol of Israel's tourism ministry. Everything's going to be great. But it's not. 10 of the 12 spies proceed to report that the people of the land are huge. We felt like grasshoppers next to them, they say. And numerous, the cities fortified, unassailable. The Israelites have no chance to capture Canaan, in spite of having God's support. It's hopeless. Two spies, Caleb and Joshua, deliver a minority report saying that with God's help, the land can be taken. But the Israelite people are terrified. Again, they ask Moses and Aaron, why did you take us from slavery just to kill us here at the hands of our enemies? At this point, God decides. This generation of former slaves will never be able to become a free people in its own land. The psychological shackles of slavery are too strong to overthrow in one generation. They must remain in the Sinai wilderness until the adults all die off, and a new generation arises that has not known slavery in its defeatist mentality. Stung by the verdict, the people turn again, attempting a leaderless invasion of the land without God's support. It fails dismally, and the people of Israel are now condemned to wander the wilderness for 38 more years, total of 40 since they left Egyptian slavery, until a new young generation will emerge to take the reins and enter the land with a fresh perspective, having been born in freedom. It's a great lesson in the process required to cleanse the trauma of failure from the minds of a community. Often it's not one single act or great revolution that truly remakes a people or a country or an organization. It's the generational turn that comes from learning that things can be done differently and better, that freedom is a birthright to be defended. In our own lives, we Jews today often share our ancestors' tendency to believe failure is permanent and success temporary. Shlach Lecha shows the danger of such belief and the importance of having faith in God and in our own ability to change for the better. Ultimately, the Israelites do enter the land of their eternal inheritance for good. We, too, have the capacity to create new, valuable, wonderful things, both individually and, most importantly, collectively. We too can enter new lands, create new organizations, new communities. What's required is faith in the support of God and the flexibility to learn, grow, and embrace change for the better. When we return on to Jewish, our guest this morning, Shannon Gagneau, author of the new memoir on conversion, Since Sinai, shares about her journey to Judaism. Hear all about it when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Our brothers, our brothers.
A.B. Yehoshua, the fiery humanist, towering author, and staunch advocate of Zionism as the answer for the Jewish condition, died this past week at the age of 85. A writer, essayist, and playwright, Yehoshua was the recipient of Israel's top cultural award, the Israel Prize, in 1995, along with dozens of other awards, including the Bialik Prize and the National Jewish Book Award. His work was translated into 28 languages, and he was often shortlisted for the Nobel Prize. Eulogizing Yehoshua, Israel's President Isaac Herzog called him one of Israel's greatest authors in all generations, who gifted us his unforgettable works, which will continue to accompany us for generations. His works drew inspiration from our nation's treasures, reflected us in an accurate, sharp, loving, and sometimes painful mirror image. He aroused in us a mosaic of deep emotions, Herzog added. Prime Minister Naftali Bennett mourned Yehoshua as one of the pillars of Israeli literature, a man whose words were read by many. He has left a crowd of readers full of admiration for the person who took a part in shaping the culture of the State of Israel. A.B. Yehoshua's work was structurally innovative, but narratively traditional. In his books, you met a raw exploration of flawed but likable protagonists, a patient, humor-laden style, and a dark storyline that deftly held you to the page. Yehoshua's sentences could be long and complex, nested with meaning. The heart of his stories were in the dialogue at which he excelled. He wrote adoringly of William Faulkner, and his style had elements of that great writer. Several of Yehoshua's greatest works came to define the era they were published. Facing the Forests, released in 1968 at the apex of post-Six-Day War Israeli euphoria, is widely seen as the most arresting exploration of the Palestinian Nakba in Hebrew literature, signaling an awakening among his generation. His first novel, The Lover, published in 1977, heralded a seismic shift in Israeli society with the rise of Likud party to power and the decline of the Ashkenazi labor left. Politically, on the question of Palestinian statehood, Yehoshua's views changed. After years of unbridled advocacy for a two-state solution, in 2016 he declared that Israel's future lay in some sort of joint endeavor that would include equal rights for Palestinians. On the centrality of Israel and Judaism, A.B. Yehoshua was, well, strident. Despite howls of protest from Jewish communities outside of Israel, he repeatedly stated that all Jews who didn't live in the State of Israel were partial Jews. Even those who spent hours poring over the Talmud and observing mitzvot were less Jewish than their brothers in Israel, where taxes and defense and all elements of daily life are determined by Jews. In a 2006 essay for the American Jewish Committee, he denied engaging in a negation of the diaspora. Jewish communities in exile, he noted waspishly, have been around since Babylonian times, 2,500 years ago, and will almost certainly endure for thousands of years into the future. Instead, it is Israel, home to half the world's Jews, that is always perched near the precipice of extinction. Exasperated with this enduring situation, Yehoshua wrote, "I have no doubt in the future when outposts are established in outer space, there will be Jews among them who will pray next year in Jerusalem while electronically orienting their space synagogue towards Jerusalem on the globe of the earth." A.B. Yehoshua was the son of an Arab language translator and a Moroccan Jewish mother. He was educated at the Gymnasia Rehavia School in Jerusalem and served in an airborne battalion during the 1956 Suez War. Yehoshua was not destined for greatness as a writer always. In the 11th grade, he had a failing mark in composition. But 10 years later, Yehoshua released his first collection of short stories and was promptly hailed as a writer of great insight and skill. Amos Oz, who at the time was still not published, wrote, "Yehoshua's unique trait is expressed in his ability to create scandalous situations and situations akin to those in a crime novel without ever slipping into the sensationalism that lies in wait." The title story of Yehoshua's 1968 collection, Facing the Forest, was a defining moment for many Israeli writers and readers alike. His next four novels, The Lover, A Late Divorce, Five Seasons, and Mr. Money, were tightly bound, integrated novellas and some of his best works. the English language cover of Mr. Money, a five-part novel that moves backward in time, carries a quote from a review in The Nation: "The Nobel Prize has been given for less." Mr. Money marked the beginning of Yehoshua's exploration in earnest of his Sephardic identity in his fiction. Yehoshua was only able to delve into those Sephardic roots after the funeral of his father. Standing on the Mount of Olives, burying the father who devoted much of his life to preserving stories of the old Sephardi families, he began to feel a story stir within him. "My cousin came to me at the funeral and said that my dad was sleeping with his fathers. That strange biblical phrase gave me the drive." In 1997, Yehoshua released A Journey to the End of the Millennium, a novel set in Middle Ages Europe, on the cusp of the year 1000. A Sephardic Jewish merchant sets off from Tangiers with his two wives and his Muslim business partner to find out what has befallen a wayward nephew. The tale crackles with a dismal appraisal of the lands of Ashkenaz from the perspective of a Sephardi from a richer, more beautiful culture. Yehoshua also wrote four books and countless articles on anti-Semitism and Zionism, on Jewish identity and politics. For 50 years in books and in Israel's newspapers, he argued strongly for a division between Israelis and Palestinians, the two-state solution. But in 2016, he changed his mind and said the goal was no longer feasible. 2 years later, 2018, he proclaimed, "We are deluding ourselves. The two-state solution is dead." Instead, he called for equality, a new thought on how Israel might grant full citizenship and rights to Palestinians and contain them in our midst. Yehoshua was fearless and combative, critiquing Israel's behavior, but that of the Palestinians too. During the Second Intifada, he lashed out at the barbarism of the Palestinian suicide bombers, likening their society to the insanity that took hold of Germany under Nazi rule. Yehoshua's partial Jew thesis of the diaspora drew vigorous criticism when, in 2012, he reiterated his assertion that the Judaism of non-Israeli Jews was like a fancy spice box, only opened to release its pleasing fragrance on Shabbat and holidays. Yehuda Kurtzer, then president of the Shalom Hartman Institute of North America, retorted, "A more frivolous analogy to Jewish practice and a more demeaning take on a vibrant diaspora Jewish community cannot be found." Still, A.B. Yehoshua, a giant of Jewish literature and of Israel's search for identity, is gone, but his influence and his writing will continue forever. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation, known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Shannon Gagneau is the author of Since Sinai, A Convert's Path to Judaism. She is a practicing attorney. By the way, if you keep practicing, do you get better at it? I would assume so. Experience helps in every area. An author on Jewish content, has a lot of stuff out on the web, and a Jew by choice. She's active in a conservative synagogue. So when you started expressing an interest in Judaism, I assume you sort of kind of casually mentioned it to some of your friends in college and so on. What was the response initially?
So I actually did it backwards. I waited until I had signed up for the Jews by Choice program in Chicago at a local synagogue, and I knew I was committed. I had the books purchased. I had a date on the calendar, and then I told everybody. And so my Jewish friends, I think, grasped the seriousness of the commitment, and for them, they understood that it wasn't a matter of if Shannon does this, but Shannon seems really set on this course, and so they were extremely enthusiastic for me. And then other people I told as I was starting to go through the courses so that I could tell them more specifically, here's what I'm experiencing, and here's how it feels to me. I was able to talk to my mother a little bit about the things that I'd experienced, the things that I'd learned, what it was like to do Jewish community service night. And I know a lot of people would have done it in reverse, like inform everyone before the course starts. But the way that I did it gave me a lot of confidence, because by the time I sat down with people for this serious conversation, the gears were in motion. And I think they just caught my enthusiasm and came along with me.
That is kind of, I don't want to say backwards, but it's definitely not the way most people approach it. Was there, were you concerned, or you just wanted to know that you had done this on your own to start with?
I think I didn't want other people, especially Jews. I thought my Jewish friends might feel nervous about the difference between trying to push me and showing too much support because Judaism is not evangelizing. I wanted them to know that I came to this decision independently and freely, and I was open to their thoughts and advice, but that it was sort of too late to sway me. And I wanted my Christian friends and family to feel the same, that this wasn't an invitation to try to convince me not to do it, that it was an update about a decision I'd already made. And so I think it allowed everyone to sort of respect where the other person was at and respect each other's boundaries. And I know even now that I'm a Jew, when people considering conversion reach out to me, I am caught between, you know, it's not cool to push people into converting to Judaism, but it's a mitzvah to help a convert on their journey back to the community. So you're always towing that careful line. And I think it helps people that I was already enrolled in classes, so they didn't feel strangely about advising me.
That's very kind of a thoughtful approach. And, you know, the process of becoming Jewish, I will say, like, so many of the people that become Jews by choice ultimately that I've worked with say, what I really like is I can ask questions. I was raised in a religion, whether it's Catholicism, evangelical Christianity, both of which you experienced, in which questioning was discouraged. In Judaism, it's an essential part of everything we do. Was that part of it for you?
I suppose it was only the questions, but the more amazing thing to me that Judaism isn't always invested in final answers or truths. I had coffee with this Orthodox rabbi who was telling a funny story about a Protestant minister called him and was like, I have this question about angels. And he said, you know, Rashi said this, and another rabbi said this, and then once I read an article that said this. And so, yeah, those are my thoughts. And the guy said, well, who's right? I'm confused. Like, what's the answer? And the Orthodox rabbi laughed and was like,
who knows?
I mean, sometimes there is an answer, right? Like, can I eat this pig if I want to keep kosher? But most of the time, we're dealing with things that have a lot of gray area. And I've had so much fun with being able to study Torah or have conversations about Midrash with people who are like, it doesn't really matter if we come to a concrete answer. What matters is we have the conversation, we have ideas, and we'll choose the answer that feels Jewish, that feels intellectually stimulating, and that it fits with the rest of halakha. But I found that to be really fun and enriching.
The process of becoming Jewish is, it doesn't end. You know, the whole purpose of Judaism for many of us is just to continue to study and grow and learn and experience. When you went through the conversion process itself, you went to the mikveh. Tell us a little bit about sort of how that felt and where you are on that continuum.
Yeah, when I went to the mikveh, I felt like I had done so much reading and studying. And I told the rabbi that oversaw my Beit Din that The only thing left is to sort of start living a Jewish life, something that you can't read in a book. You just have to do it. And so for me, it was a lot like raising my daughter, taking her to Tot Shabbat for the first time after she was born, and figuring out, okay, what synagogue after we move to New York City am I going to call home, and how am I going to be involved in the community, and what kind of continuing education classes are interesting to me. For me, it's looked a little bit like enrolling in a very intensive ulpan so that my Hebrew can be a lot better than it was when I went to the mikveh. And that, I think, is the biggest leap of faith, because you sort of have to be prepared to say Judaism is a religion of doing, and it's a community religion that we do together. So at some point you have to put down the books, and you have to put down the 42 Torah websites you subscribe to, and you have to go out there, put yourself out there and do it with other Jews. And that's been, I think, really rewarding and great for me. It just is different than that intensive studying phase.
What's your favorite Jewish holiday?
I always, I give a different answer every time because I like all of them so much. But I think that my favorite holiday, and one that I think is underrated, is Sukkot or Sukkot.
That's my favorite holiday too, I just have to tell you. So you're doing well so far. Keep going.
Oh, that's great. I think like Judaism's connection to the natural world and cycles of time has been really grounding for me, whether it's just Shabbos or Kodesh or Sukkot and Shavuos, like being really connected to how much time has passed and what's happened in the world. I like sharing meals with people. I'm also very charmed by the technical dimensions of building a sukkah and its rules and requirements to be a kosher sukkah. I think Judaism is beautifully precise in a lot of ways, and so there are plenty of good study pieces, but it's also so much about having food and conversations with friends, getting outside. The whole thing is just, it hits all the buttons on things that really work for me. So I think the people who are born Jewish who don't so much celebrate Sukkot are missing out, because I think it's really underrated and it's really great.
You're not born Jewish, but your kid is. Tell us a little bit about how that changes things.
Yeah, I honestly think I got really lucky, because my daughter was born 3 months after the conversion, which means I went to the mikveh pregnant with her. And for us, I think we felt less lost about how to live a Jewish life after the mikveh, because what you do when you have a Jewish child is sort of like, okay, so we schedule the baby naming, and we pay for the young family's membership at a shul, and we join Tot Shabbat. And we enrolled her when we moved to New York in a Jewish preschool that also did a good job of incorporating the holidays and Shabbat into her life. And so it gave us this really nice framework of a way to keep being Jewish when the kind of bumpers of the conversion course were no longer there. And I think it's great that she won't necessarily grow up feeling like this is a space where I'm behind, where I'm not as learned as other kids. I feel like she has had an opportunity in New York City to be immersed in Jewishness all the time, and I'm really happy that we can give that to her. But I think parenting, especially Jewish parenting, because it's something the community cares so much about, is something that's been a great way for us to just seamlessly integrate into the community.
What was the most challenging thing for you about becoming Jewish?
I think just the Hebrew, that you're worshiping and learning in a language that takes a really long time to learn. Like the alphabet takes up so much of the year-long conversion class, just getting people to read words correctly and to spell things correctly and, you know, get the right sound, that it sort of puts you behind for actually understanding either biblical or modern Hebrew. And I've worked really hard, because nobody wants to go to services and not be able to find the spot where they're at in the siddur, because it's really hard to follow along with Hebrew when you're not good at it. And there's nothing to say for that other than it's a big time investment. It's been like a lot of studying, and my husband has more of a musical brain, so he has gotten by doing a little bit less on Hebrew study, but he somehow is way better at, you know, praying along out loud with the Vehatzah or whatever. He just memorized it. Like, he can't read it, he just knows it. But for me, it was definitely the language barrier.
You are not alone in that sentiment. I think the vast majority of people who convert to Judaism and aren't great linguists find the Hebrew challenging. What's your favorite part about being Jewish?
I think it's the excitement that Jews have for meeting fellow Jews and the connection we feel with each other, even if we have a somewhat different practice. I've gone to during COVID, I went to different outdoor Jewish events in Prospect Park. There was a big Simchat Torah party that was mostly Reform and some conservative Jews, and I've taken my daughter to some Chabad events in Manhattan because they tend to have a lot of children's programming, and we all, I think, have very different practices and beliefs, but there's still this excitement about being together. Not always, you know, I think people butt heads here and there, but I found that mostly Jews are just thrilled to be together, to be worshiping together, to be building community together, and that's been really special, that it doesn't always have to be a case of getting us to where we believe the exact same way, but that a lot of times being together is enough.
In the course of preparing for conversion, you've written this book. You've mentioned in some of the promotional material that there just wasn't a lot to read, a lot of contemporary stuff anyway, about conversion to Judaism. What kind of advice would you give to someone who's interested, is exploring Judaism, thinking about becoming Jewish?
I would say to get off the internet, because you're going to go down some rabbit holes of information that's either not accurate or just too much, and stick with the basics, which is finding other people who walk the same road. It's never cool to single out converts, but some people like me are more open about it, or somebody in your congregation locally around you might be willing, if you talk to the rabbi, he or she might be willing to track down someone who converted, because I think personal connections helped me so much more. And I'm an avid reader. I read way too many books during the process. Books are amazing, but I think not being afraid to seek out personal connections, because people are often scared or shy or worried about rejection, but the more that you meet other Jews and other converts, the more that that sort of melts away, because those personal first-person accounts and being welcomed and being able to ask questions to a real person and not a page on the internet, it's really invaluable.
Where can people go to find out more about you, Shannon, and more about Since Sinai, A Convert's Path to Judaism?
They can mostly find me on Twitter. I'm pretty active there, mostly about Jewish stuff, and they can reach out to me there. My inbox is always completely open, no privacy settings, so anybody can contact me. And I love talking to people that are considering Judaism or people whose spouses are considering Judaism. And, you know, I think people are afraid that, like, if they reach out to a local rabbi in lieu of me or another convert, that they're going to get shut down. And I've not met people more excited to talk about Judaism than rabbis. I think that's also a really great option for people to just reach out to whoever happens to live closest geographically. And I've always gotten an extremely warm reception, 10 times out of 10.
Thank you so much, Shannon. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest. Her book is called Since Sinai, A Convert's Path to Judaism. And when we return, we'll have a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guests will be Rabbis Richard Agler and Rifat Sansino, discussing their groundbreaking new book on Jewish belief and meaning, A God We Can Believe In. And don't forget, join us at Congregation Beit Simcha in person or on Facebook every Friday night for services at Oneg Shabbat starting at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning, too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, live in person and available on Facebook. Our playout this morning is Shlomo Carlbach's Lecha Dodi, his melody to welcome the Sabbath. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a sunny week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace. Shalom al-Bas,
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.